You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, jam-packed, jam-packed, Jeff Conathan, am I pronouncing that right? Former Biden staffer, former Uber lobbyist, former Ted Kaufman, Senator Ted Kaufman staffer, and now author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. And then to the West Coast, where we'll be talking to Ron Seifert from TarSandBlockade.org. They are involved in direct action. I guess not the West Coast. Relative of the West Coast of the Hudson River. The far West Coast of the Hudson River. Giving us an update on what's happening with these tar sand protests. Protests in the air around the country. Walmart walkouts happening across the country at Walmarts as we speak. Workers fighting back. Occupy working to save the home of a retired police officer in Georgia. President Obama clarifies his statements on Social Security. A shorter version, be afraid. Be very, very afraid. And just to wrap it all up, Congressman says evolution formed in the pit of hell. He's finally seen the light. Guy sits on the Science Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. So good luck with that. Folks, listen. As you know, yesterday I was a pre-record. We had on Kevin Baker examining the questions as why we should vote. Very strange weekend for me. I went to a memorial for David Rakoff. Just very sad, but also beautiful, very touching. And I'm still trying to dig up some earlier interviews that I did with Rakoff, just because it's a tremendous loss for all of us. But and then interspersed throughout the weekend and on Monday and on Friday when I was walking my daughter to school, people just constantly calling me and walking up to me. What about the polls? What about the debate? What about what's going on? Is Obama going to lose? What about this Pew poll? What about this Daily Kos poll? What about this poll that says that, look, and again, of course, the funnest part is that you all remember that 7 days ago, the conservatives were talking about how all the polls have been manipulated to depress the turnout. Most of what's going on with the polling can be explained by a couple of things. Statistical noise. An increase in Republicans now saying that they're going to vote for Romney. I think the Pew poll that has the, what was it, Romney up by four or something? I don't know. I didn't even pay that much attention. Also had Romney making up an 18-point gap with women. I find that very hard to believe. I guess it's possible, but I find it extremely hard to believe. Are Republicans more enthused? Probably. Demographically speaking, does that make of a difference? No. Did that debate fundamentally change the race? I guess, depending on your definition of fundamentally. Because had Obama had a good debate, it would have ended the campaign probably then. Frankly, good. Good. I hope Obama has to come out and be a little bit stronger at the... I hope he has to come out and draw a brighter line with Social Security, frankly. We'll talk about that later in the program. But President Obama is still giving himself wiggle room to cut Social Security in a way that Vice President Biden, the day, 2 days after Ryan was picked, said no changes, no cuts. I guarantee it. So it'll make it interesting at the debate later this week, at least. All right, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the former super lobbyist, former Stennett Saffer, on his book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Win. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Want to welcome Jeff Connaughton to the program, former Senate staffer, former White House staffer, former Uber lobbyist, and now author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
So, Jeff, I mean, before we get into, you know, where we are today, and your story is really an amazing story and one that it gives us tremendous insight and, frankly, sort of a depressing insight.
Into, I am depressed.
I can appreciate that. And I'm doing my best to keep a smile on my face. But wait, walk us through just a little bit of your life, because, you know, one thing that strikes me, you know, as we go through this is that the interesting thing about how Wall Street has become sort of the focus of someone like my ire is that I don't talk about K Street like I used to. And maybe I should be, at least that's the conduit, but lobbyists are not as vilified as they certainly were 5 years ago. But walk us through your trajectory, because you sort of a, I don't know, I guess a idealist to not idealist to idealist story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I tried to write my own story interwoven with the Ted Kaufman and Senate story, because I kind of feel like my career is representative of what thousands of young people who go to Washington sort of inevitably get sucked into, in that I met Joe Biden when I was in college. I told him if he ever ran for president, I'd help him. 7 years later, I moved to Washington in 1987 to work on the first Biden for president campaign, stayed, worked for him on the Senate staff, where I got to know Ted Kaufman very well. He was the senator's, or then senator's chief of staff. But, you know, then I went off to law school and was clerking for a judge who got named White House counsel. So my dream of working in the White House came true after all, but, you know, only out of luck, because Ab Mikva worked for Bill Clinton in the Clinton White House. But when I came out of the White House, you know, I was practicing law. Practicing law wasn't a whole lot of fun. And, you know, Jack Quinn, who I got to know in the Clinton White House, asked me if I wanted to start a legislative regulatory practice with him at Arnold and Porter. And I actually, for the next 12 years, had a pretty sane, you know, wonderful life and career working as a lobbyist, a corporate lobbyist, and making a lot of money. We met a guy named Ed Gillespie, whose rise has just been meteoric in the Republican Party. I mean, he's Mitt Romney's top advisor right now, and we did quite well. But when the financial crisis came along, I saw it as a once-in-my-lifetime event, a once-in-60-year sort of devastating event for millions of Americans. So when Ted was asked to fill Joe Biden's seat in the Senate for 2 years and immediately saying he wasn't going to run in the special election, I mean, he had been my mentor for 20 years at that point. He said, why don't you come back and be my chief of staff? And, you know, among other things, we'll really go after Wall Street hard for 2 years. And, you know, I had done the same thing in the Clinton White House in 1995. I mean, I had seen Wall Street's power growing in Washington then. And Ab Mikva, you know, the great progressive judge who served Clinton, you know, was very much against the contract with America and the restrictions it would have put and did put on our legal system through the Securities Class Action Reform Act, product law. So I knew, you know, these were the bills that Clinton vetoed at Mikva's urging. I knew Wall Street's power was growing. I benefited from the growth in Wall Street's power. But when I had my chance to get back in government, you know, Ted really sort of represented, here's what we might get if you took money out of politics. I mean, he didn't have to raise a dime to become a senator or to stay there because he wasn't running. I was different from most staffers because I had already gone through the revolving door and had made a lot of money, so I didn't have to worry about where my next job was coming from. So for 2 years, we really tried hard, you know, to get the Justice Department to prosecute Wall Street executives, to get the SEC to do something about high-frequency trading, and to break up the too-big-to-fail banks. And we failed on all three fronts, and I was just so disillusioned and sort of realize, you know what, I think I should lay the facts bare. That's what I can contribute at this point in my career. So I left town to write this book to sort of tell the story of why we failed.
You know, there's to be fair, I've really only skimmed the book at this point, and I'm going to, you know, jump in. I mean, one of the things that has really struck me sort of just, you know, as in my job is, I was aware of your book in August, and, you know, usually the way this works for me is that I'm playing catch up just based upon the resources that I have. I'm a little bit, you know, sometimes a little ahead of the curve, sometimes a little behind it. But there's been a real I'm just shocked at how little attention in some respects your book has gotten. Is that something that, you know, I want to obviously go through sort of the substance, but I want to get a sense of your take. I mean, because
it's been invisible in Washington. I mean, it's been absolutely invisible. I mean, I've gotten some good notices from people who, especially the columnists who followed Kaufman and Light Kaufman have written about it, but the book has really had zero impact inside the Beltway so far, which is surprising because, I mean, to me, I felt like I was really writing a tell-all that was rare for Washington in that, you know, not a, you know, important person who everybody has heard of, but here's somebody who spent his whole career as sort of a mid-level staffer, a mid-level lobbyist, really trying to lay bare what has become, you know, just a too powerful, too much money, almost corrupt, not in the statutory sense, but almost corrupt system in Washington. And it's not had much of an impact. I mean, it really hasn't. And partly it's because we're in this very tribal period of Obama versus Romney. And, you know, the media is covering what the two presidential candidates are saying. and neither presidential candidate is talking about the financial crisis for Wall Street very much because they don't want to talk about it.
Right.
They want to raise money from Wall Street.
Well, yeah, I want to get to that. And it's a cautionary note for publishers out there. The idea that, it's a book about politics. Let's do it during the election. I think also part of it is I think you pissed off a lot of people. Let's take the first part about, I'm curious as to how you perceived your move through that revolving door into lobbying and what it was that sort of drove you out. I'm convinced that one of the biggest, and you, I think you outlined this at least, correct me if I'm wrong. One of the problems that we have is a careerism, that has taken hold in Washington, that combined with some other, I guess, factors, but careerism really sort of stops people before that they're going to really push on any particular issue at any given time?
Well, the career, there was a study of where House staffers went in the last 2 years by the Sunlight Foundation. More than 400 staffers of the House went to work as lobbyists. I mean, in the 20 years I was in Washington, or the 12 years I was a lobbyist, the amount of money that corporate America spends in Washington tripled. And it's just like Wall Street. I mean, when the benefits explode, and the costs of behavior, the norms erode, people start making different rational choices. And it's, the amount of money you can now make in Washington as a former public servant is enormous. And I'm not just talking about lobbyists. I'm talking about anyone. I mean, any lawyer at the top of the Justice Department, any official at the top of the Ag Department, any foreign policy maven, you can make up, the private sector is basically waiting to hire you for your contacts and your ability to influence governmental decision making, and you can make a lot of money. And, it all started changing with sort of Clark Clifford and Henry Kissinger, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But now, even Jeff Connaughton, someone you've never heard of, after spending a, 18-month tour in the Clinton White House, can do pretty well for himself in lobbying. And they're not a lot of career choices in Washington. I mean, corporate America is showering money. I mean, on public relations firms, on law firms, on grassroots firms, on lobbying firms, on strategic consulting firms. That's where you go when the revolving door turns. Now, there are a lot of good people who, when they serve in government, understand they're being paid by the taxpayer, and it's their job to look out for the public interest. But the fact of the matter is, when there's that much money being showered on Washington, it just skews outcomes. And that's what I thought was going wrong in the response to the financial crisis. I didn't see the system responding to the crisis the way Ted and I believed it ought to be responding. And therefore...
What was it? What pushed you? Was it just simply that? You're seeing...
There wasn't a single indictment of a Wall Street banker. Ted did two oversight hearings at the Senate Judiciary Committee of financial fraud prosecutions. The Justice Department simply did not make a good faith effort to investigate Wall Street. That's just a fact. The president himself essentially admitted it in the State of the Union when he appointed a second mortgage fraud task force this year, because there just hadn't been enough effort. And after both those hearings and the private meetings we had held with Justice Department officials, I just felt like we had been misled and gamed by the Justice Department. They kept claiming publicly and privately that they were undertaking a comprehensive and robust investigation, and it's just plain to everyone now that they weren't. They left the cases spread out across the country to U.S. attorney's offices that just didn't have the kind of exceptional, muscled-up, centralized resources. It would have taken a timely, concerted, purposeful, all-in effort to really get to the bottom, of these massive amounts of transactions, some of which were fraudulent, some of which I'm convinced, were deserving of criminal prosecution. And that didn't happen. And I just refused to be an accomplice to that by remaining silent. That more than anything pushed me out of town. I just couldn't,
All right. Well, I understand. That's why you wrote the book. I'm just curious as to Kaufman calls and says, I'm going to be senator. This is what I'm going to do. Do you want to leave? Basically, had you felt at that point you had collected all the chips? I mean, you really basically cashed in your chips. Did you know when you were doing this that you were going to be doing that?
Well, I was torn because I had quite a comfortable life, in Washington. And I could have, even after 2 years with Ted, I could have gone back to that very comfortable life in Washington. But I was very, very angry with Wall Street. I mean, when people would ask us, why are y'all so focused on Wall Street reform? My question back was always, I'm wondering why, the other 534 members of Congress aren't as focused on it as we are. I mean, it was devastating. I had friends around the country who had been devastated by it. And, to me, it was just clear that, the system needed to focus on, what is our response to this crisis so that we can never again have to live through this, so our economy can thrive during long periods of financial stability. And, we didn't get prosecutions. The SEC turned out to be, in my view, an agency that regulates in consensus with Wall Street. And the Senate, wouldn't stand up to the Wall Street technocrats, who had gotten us into the trouble in the first place at the Treasury Department and the Fed, who didn't want any statutory lines, anything, bright lines in the bill that would actually preclude their ability to regulate the banks the way they see fit. And in the short run, I think the regulators will do a better job, but Ted believed that the best long-term solution was to break up the banks, to put bright line leverage limits in the bill. But, the Obama administration was against that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the Brown-Kaufman amendment, Kaufman-Brown amendment, which essentially would have called for a statutory response to the size of these banks and would have broken them up. It's interesting because at one point in your book, Senator Durbin comes up to, I guess, Senator Kaufman and says, Jamie Dimon wants you to know that it's the small banks who really were responsible for this. And this is also, from the outside, we hear Senator Durbin complain that the Senate is owned by the banks, or by the bankers, I think he sort of famously said. But it doesn't appear necessarily that he's on that he's not one of those people. But give me your sense.
Well, he did vote for the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, Senator Durbin, but he also was publicly quoted as saying it may be a bridge too far. I mean, it was like a consciousness expanding experiment. I mean, people just couldn't wrap their minds around the idea that we actually were going to break up the banks. I mean, they just thought that was too dramatic a move. Yet we still have this debate raging in this country today about whether we ought to reimpose Glass-Steagall and whether we ought to break up the banks. I mean, Sandy Weill, who was the ultimate mega banker, himself, the man who put Citigroup together, has said, we need to reimpose Glass-Steagall. So,
and when we talk about breaking up the banks, that's essentially all we're talking about is going back to what existed in the mid-90s as Glass-Steagall was sort of slowly taken apart and then finally, I guess, put to bed by the
Graham-Leach-Bliley in 1999. Right. Yeah, I mean, I always felt like Ted was taking a conservative position. I refused to see these issues as sort of left-right issues. I mean, conservative into why don't we go back to what worked in the past? I mean, we put in place after the Great Depression these financial reforms like Glass-Steagall that maintained financial stability for decades. And the argument we always got back was, well, the eggs are already too scrambled, and we've modernized and sophisticated our financial institutions, and it's too late, to do anything of that kind of dramatic nature. And Ted would say, why? Why not? That's what caused the problem. It got so out of control that regulators found that it was too difficult to regulate because no one understood. Even the CEOs of these banks couldn't understand the complexity of the financial instruments that they were selling. Why can't we turn the clock back and just not enough senators could sort of get their mind around, you know, that idea.
To what extent, I mean, give me a sense of the interplay here. I mean, at one point, I guess Dianne Feinstein, when she was told what the Brown-Kaufman Amendment meant, she was like, this is still America, isn't it? We wouldn't break up the banks. I mean, I get the sense from this that it's a sort of like a and you refer to, I guess, the forces that really act upon these decisions as the blob. Tell us what that is and how much that includes sort of staffers who have misaligned incentives, senators who don't really have the time or the inclination or the capacity, frankly, to understand these issues. How much of it is it sort of just money, careerism, or misapprehensions about what the electoral value of it is or whether or not it's going to crash the economy? What does that equation look like?
Well, the blob, as I call it and others call it in Washington, is the Senate Banking Committee, the SEC, the Treasury, the Fed, and all the lobbyists and Wall Street representatives who constantly surround them and permeate their ranks. I mean, they go to parties together, they're in constant communication with each other, they're swapping intelligence with each other, and it's a very deeply cultural group of Wall Street, Washington financial technocrats who think that only they understand how to fix the banks or what's, you know, what our policy should be towards the banks. And they all do quite well, you know, moving through the revolving door. You know, I even say in the book that if you really want to maximize your income in Washington, you should marry a member of the blob and then take turns. You know, one of you work as a regulator and the other work in the industry because you're always able to swap information about what's going on inside government. But, you know, we were not in the blob and that Ted was not on the banking committee, so we had very little transparency into what was going on in the banking committee. And most senators off the committee do defer to the expertise on the banking committee. I mean, that's what committees are supposed to be. You know, the experts who sort of spend most of their time dealing on the subject matter they have jurisdiction over. But when that committee becomes so part of the blob, you know, so captured both, you know, by the mind share and the financial contributions, you know, coming from the people they're supposed to regulate, then, you know, you have this sort of skewed outcome. And, you know, it's a deep problem. I mean, I try to unpack it as best I can in the book, but it's a cultural way of life for sort of Wall Street, Washington financial technocrats.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of sort of more current stories and how you perceive them in the context of your experience here. There was a story just yesterday in I think it was in the Times that Goldman Sachs is not going to be funding Democrats and President Obama in this election like they have in the past. In fact, they've basically gone 180, and it's not the corporate entity, but all of the players within Goldman Sachs. And I look at this and, you know, we're talking about, I mean, it's a rather large story in the New York Times, and we're talking about $30 million. Maybe it's a little bit more. Maybe it's more as you extend it out, but President Obama raised 181 last month. And so when I see stories like this, I start to wonder, is this story just so, I mean, is it the Obama campaign that is really hyping this story? I mean, and it also dovetails into this, the Big Bird ad that came out today, which I think is a great ad, but it basically takes on Romney for saying that Big Bird is the problem, in other words, funding PBS as opposed to Wall Street. But there's been nothing that we have seen from the Obama administration in terms of, like you say, indicting Wall Street or in any way curbing their excesses. Give me your sense of those two, both the ad and this story.
Right. Well, I mean, Obama in 2008 certainly raised a lot of his money from Wall Street, even though as a percentage of the total, you're right, it's probably not gigantic compared to the small donor contributions. The Republican Party just made a conscious decision while the Democrats were trying to do the responsible thing of coming up with some kind of financial reform in Congress, they just made a decision to band together and make this a fundraising opportunity for them with Wall Street. And they opposed pretty much any idea that Democrats put forward, and you know, used it to sort of stick tight and go to Wall Street and say, you know, we will be the party for Wall Street. You know, in the past, Democrats have raised most of the money out of Wall Street. So there has been this gigantic shift, and Romney has raised a lot of money from Wall Street. But both parties are still doing it. I mean, don't kid yourself. I mean, you know, there's still a lot of money from Wall Street going to the Obama and other Democrats. And I just think, you know, we don't have a two-party system when it comes to Wall Street. I mean, both parties are, you know, in a competition to raise more money from Wall Street. Now, the Big Bird ad, you know, I thought was particularly interesting this morning because in trying to paint Romney as more interested in attacking Sesame Street than Wall Street, the Obama ad names three criminals, Bernie Madoff, Ken Lay, and Dennis Kozlowski, all of whom were not prosecuted by the Obama administration. I mean, Ken Lay and Dennis Kozlowski were prosecuted by the Bush Department of Justice, so they couldn't even come up with one name for their own ad of someone they had prosecuted on Wall Street.
What do you think makes it? I mean, it's obviously like, look, I mean, President Obama right now can see that he's not getting this this money, at least to the extent that he was before. Do you think it's really just they didn't want to offend their potential investors, potential donors in their campaign, or is it something more sort of systemic, something more having to do with, I don't know, there's an anecdote you mentioned about the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act in the Clinton administration, where President Clinton was very concerned about the sort of establishment. Is that what this is about? I mean, is it really more about, less about how much money is going to come in, but more about like these are my people, or there's just a...
Well, the power of Wall Street. I mean, a few years ago, 42% of all American corporate profits came from Wall Street. I mean, we have really financialized our economy, and Wall Street had become extremely powerful before the financial crisis. And while it's taken, you know, a certain hit, I mean, it's still one of the most powerful forces in America. I mean, obviously. And, you know, when there's no countervailing force that comes even close to sort of standing up and saying, wait a minute, let's not necessarily do everything the way Wall Street wants. Now, I will say, you know, in early 2009, when the president took office, I mean, people were deeply concerned about the fragility of the international financial system. I mean, Bernanke and Geithner came up and briefed the freshman senators, and Ted said you could see, you know, how scared they were. They didn't know where these credit default swaps started and ended. I mean, there were problems in Iceland and the Royal Bank of Scotland. So I think early on, that, you know, the president just decided, I'm going to let these guys off the hook because we need the banks to recover, and that's going to be the, you know, sort of the first step towards economic recovery. And that was a false choice. I mean, the Justice Department still could have focused on individuals, still should have held accountable individuals who broke the law. I mean, we didn't need to make this sort of macro decision that we shouldn't touch a single hair on any banker's head until we've righted the financial ship. And I think that's in essence, you know, what we decided to do.
But do you think that? The financial fraud task force that was set up earlier this year with Eric Schneiderman sitting as one of the co-chairs, which as far as I can tell, I mean, Schneiderman just brought a suit, but from everything that I've read about it, this suit wasn't really that reliant upon the financial fraud task force. I mean, it's being filed under the Martin Act in New York State. Maybe there's been some sort of like support, but it doesn't seem like this task force, in other words, is actually really doing anything anyways. And it's not like we don't still have the Justice Department. If it was the case that we're worried, we don't know, this is like a Jenga game, and we're afraid of pulling out a stick somewhere because we don't want the whole thing to fall. At what point do we get past that? And if we do get past that, does President Obama make a different decision, or is it just like, why not just turn the page?
Well, you know, I think the statutes of limitations have a lot to say about that. I mean, right. You know, it's in a certain amount of time, it's going to be too late to bring more cases. I mean, I want to hope, you know, that Schneiderman and the New York State Attorney General's office will do something real, but I've kind of learned my lesson, you know, not putting blind faith and trust in law enforcement leaders when you're getting, you know, indications, as you say, that there's barely any staff, you know, at the task force that are adding any kind of muscle to a real approach, you know, and the very timing of the announcement of his recent case and the press conference that he held at the Justice Department just seemed suspect. I mean, we deserve to have prosecutions done at a time when it didn't look like, you know, they were motivated by, you know, political timing. So I think it's outrageous. I think it's a stain on the American justice system that, you know, we just simply didn't have a Justice Department that made a strong enough effort so that we wouldn't be having this debate years later. I think it's torn our social fabric in ways that are very destructive. But I also think during this campaign season, a lot of people have just decided to compartmentalize, you know, and it's just, oh, the financial crisis, I'm tired of talking about that. You know, I'm going to vote for Obama or Romney on the basis of other issues.
Right. Right. Let me ask you one more sort of completely unrelated, not completely unrelated, but that you might have some insight into. You know, Tim Pawlenty, basically, he's a guy who just cashed in his chips, as far as I can tell, to become head of the Financial Services Roundtable. Is that, I mean, just characterize that. I mean, is this guy who just basically says, okay, I'm done with politics, it's now time for me to make some cash, A, and B, from the perspective of this lobbying group, what's the value of a guy who's not been in Washington?
Right. Well, on the first, I mean, I do think it's sort of a rubber band effect. I mean, he came very close to being named Romney's vice presidential running mate. He may be very disappointed, you know, that he didn't get that. But he realized, okay, I've kind of topped out in politics. You know, maybe I could be ag secretary in a Romney term. Or I can go join the financial establishment, make lots of money, you know, be, you know, have my family and my heirs, you know, do well with the money I'll make over the next decade. And, you know, so I'm going to go do it. Now, you know, why pick a guy like him? Well, the first thing you need if you're a CEO of a financial industry company is you need access, you know, and Tim Pawlenty will be able to provide access. And I think, you know, I mean, I guess they'd never consider naming a Democrat. You'd think they'd wait till after the election to decide who they'd hire to head the group.
You'd think Pawlenty would wait. I mean, you know, like, I've got this job. I'm one of the co-chairs of this. F it. I'm just going to take this. I don't need to wait.
Well,
I don't need to give them 3 weeks of.
It used to be mainly ex-staffers who were the lobbyists in town. I mean, now it really is former members and former senators.
Right.
I mean, there's a restaurant in Washington called Tosca where a lot of lobbyists like to go to lunch. And if you walk in there, I mean, you know, you have to say good afternoon, Senator, to half the people you run into. You know, there's Tom Daschle. There's Blanche Lincoln. I mean, there's, you know, there's just all sorts of people who, once their career in politics is over, they start making literally millions of dollars in the private sector, and not necessarily as lobbyists, as, quote, strategic consultants, end quote. I mean, one of the results of the Obama effort to demonize lobbyists is we just have people who don't register as lobbyists, even though they're doing what essentially amounts to lobbying.
All right. Well, let me we just got a minute left here. Let me ask you I'm afraid of the answer, so I'm very hesitant to ask you on this, but What can be done at this point? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a good answer and a bad answer. The bad answer is we have this perpetual money machine flowing from Washington of people in power, you know, just in a constantly revolving door, and it's very hard to figure out how you put that in reverse. I mean, you know, repealing Citizens United, the Supreme Court jurisprudence on campaign finance, I mean, that would take a constitutional amendment, and money alone would probably block that from happening. I think eventually the Tea Party, the Occupy people, but more importantly, non-financial corporate America will realize we can't have repeated financial crises holding back the economy. And it's going to take power to beat power in Washington. And I think the power that will do it, I hope, you know, is non-financial corporate America. I mean, Lou Gerstner, the ex-CEO of IBM, said out loud not too long ago, a lot of us in the business community are getting fed up with Wall Street. Well, when that happens, you know, when the IBMs and the Xeroxes and the Walmarts and the Home Depots, you know, decide, you know what, we can't make any money if Wall Street keeps, you know, shaking the markets every 5 years, you know, then maybe we'll get some kind of meaningful reform.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate your coming on, and that's that was I guess more optimistic than I had feared. Jeff Connaughton, author, Payoff: Why Wall Street Always Wins. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we have got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Ron Seifert from tarsandblockade.org. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Ron Seifert. He is from tarsandblockade.org. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And Ron, what's your title with tarsandsblockade.org?
I'm a spokesperson for the campaign.
Okay, great. Well, So get us up to speed here. I know there's been basically direct action for what I think is going on weeks now, right? Tell us what's happening there, and where are you?
Well, I'm in East Texas right now, and that is correct. Tar Sands Blockade is running a rolling nonviolent civil disobedience campaign to stop, literally stop, Keystone XL pipeline construction here in East Texas. It's been ongoing since August. So there hasn't been much national fanfare regarding the construction process, but I do guarantee you it's in full swing. Construction sites are all over the place, both in Oklahoma and Texas. And the blockade has been successful in multiple occasions in bringing folks who are interested in stopping this to construction sites. And they have done various things to shut construction sites down for days. The highlight of all this is our ongoing tree blockade. We have the largest tree village and tree sit action in Texas history. It stretches over 500 feet of the Keystone right-of-way. It involves multiple over a dozen trees, as well as a timber wall, a wall like a scaffolding built of the forest itself, at the top of which has a catwalk and along which blockaders can protect the easement as well. So there's over a half.
Ron, are you there? Ron? Ron, are you with us? We'll try him back. Ron? All right, so Ron, you were telling us about the this tree blockade. Tell us, I mean, let's back up just a moment here. Give people an understanding as to why this pipeline is still being built in Texas and Oklahoma. How is it that the case? While you know there was a sense that there had basically been a moratorium put on the building, but why is it going forward in these states?
That's a great question, Sam. So ultimately what's going on is the Keystone XL pipeline has been divided into two segments, a northern segment and a southern segment. The northern segment is what's being put on hold and what requires approval from the president and from the State Department. That's because it crosses our federal border with Canada. The southern segment that's only running through Oklahoma and Texas doesn't need approval from the State Department. And in fact, Obama himself last March issued an executive order to expedite construction of this southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. So he ordered his administrative bodies, his regulators like the EPA, to quote unquote cut through the red tape to get this pipeline online fast as possible. So Obama's basically tried to have it both ways. He's tried to appease environmentalists by saying he's postponed or denied permits for the Keystone XL. At the same time, he's expediting construction of half the pipeline, which we've seen ongoing for the past month and a half.
So, when this land is taken by eminent domain, is this done by the state of Texas, by the state of Oklahoma, by the federal government? Who in fact is taking this land? Because people should understand, this is not the Keystone Pipeline buying people's land. Because people are lining up to sell their land to it. This is all by eminent domain. Is that right?
That's correct. It's the states themselves. So in the case of the southern leg of the Keystone Pipeline, Oklahoma and Texas have granted TransCanada the extraordinary power of eminent domain, a power that's usually only afforded to states and federal governments. So ultimately this foreign corporation, this multinational corporation, is allowed to unilaterally condemn property and expropriate land from American citizens. So this process actually began several years ago, and ultimately landowners received letters without any other notice saying, "Hi, we're TransCanada. We're building a pipeline. We have the power to take your land. We're going to give you a very low price for your property, and if you don't like that, we're going to condemn it, take you to court, and you're going to lose, so you might as well take our money anyway." So a lot of people under prejudice and duress, signed land agreements with TransCanada because they felt they had no other choice. They were going to lose it one way or another, so they thought, hey, might as well get a few bucks out of it in the process. But over 100 landowners in Texas alone refused to even sign the contract. They thought that this was wrong, that this was, that their constitutionally protected land rights ought not be imperiled with such nonchalance. So they refused and they held out, and sure enough, their property was condemned. The pipeline is being rammed right through their homes, their ranches, their farms. And they're being put directly in harm's way when they wanted absolutely nothing to do with this project from the outset.
I mean, this is pretty stunning. I just don't, I mean, you know, I don't know if you're an attorney, but I don't understand how eminent domain is in play here when, in fact, it's quite possible. I mean, at this point, there's no evidence anyways that there's actually going to even be a pipeline, right? I mean, we may, from a political sense, and our intuition may be that the president has given the okay for the southern leg, that he ultimately will okay the northern leg, but it doesn't exist there. And so I don't understand how there's any type of state interest involved in taking this land.
Right. There's two glaring legal issues with this eminent domain battle. First is what you referred to, that this entitlement of eminent domain was granted to TransCanada before they had even received any of the necessary permits to build this pipeline. So before the pipeline was even permitted or approved by any agency, the state gave them the power to take land for a project that on paper didn't even exist yet, which is really unconscionable. But in addition to that, the whole idea of them being a common carrier, a utility that is intended for the public good or the public interest, is one of the necessary conditions for this eminent domain entitlement. So eminent domain isn't supposed to be used for private gain. It's only supposed to be used in the public interest when what you're doing services the general public. So TransCanada has made that claim, that this Keystone XL pipeline is for the public good, for the public interest, that they are a common carrier of petroleum. And that's just a bald-faced lie.
Are they claiming the public good of Asia? Or because is there any evidence? Has anybody even asserted that any of this petroleum is going to be consumed in the United States?
Well, there's plenty of, you know, sound bites from TransCanada PR people that stake that claim, but there's no factual evidence. TransCanada has yet to authenticate or verify any of its claims that there's going to be any benefit to America or to the citizens whose land is being expropriated. So ultimately, the only evidence that we do have points to the exact opposite, as you mentioned, that this is going to be an export pipeline. In fact, last December, TransCanada's president, Alex Pourbaix, in a hearing on energy future in America, was questioned by Congressman Edward Markey. And that exchange is documented. There's video evidence of it. And he, the president of TransCanada, has clearly stated, we cannot guarantee that this product will stay in the United States. We've already signed contracts with shippers, and they can do whatever they want with it. And then these shipping companies, these refiners, are claiming that all the money's in the developing world. They're anxious to export more and more. That's where the market's going. So all signs point towards this being a private, for-profit project to enrich a multinational corporation at the expense of homes, ranches, and farms here in Texas and Oklahoma.
Ron, now, I've seen reports of some people, landowners, of protesters coming to protect landowner rights, of chaining themselves to some of the machinery that is being used to, I guess, bulldoze trees and other other aspects of the land to build this pipeline. And while they've been chained up to these machines, police have come in and actually tased them, pepper sprayed them, beaten them. Is this the case? Are you aware of these incidents?
Yes. Thanks for bringing that up. We are well aware of it. And in fact, there's one instance in particular where two blockaders
who were locked to each other. They had their arms locked together, sticking through the frame of a piece of machinery. So they weren't actually locked to the machine itself, but to each other through its framing, were approached by police officers only after TransCanada supervisors huddled with them and what appeared to be instructed them on what they wanted to see happen. The police officers then put these protesters into stress positions, you know, like wrenching their arms behind their backs. They then restrained the protesters with handcuffs, handcuffing their arms to the heavy equipment itself while in these stress positions. And then while the protesters were restrained, not only locked to each other, but their free arms locked to the machinery, they proceeded to put the protesters in chokeholds. They pepper sprayed them. They contorted the locks around their arms to abrade their skin. And they tased them multiple times, all while being restrained. So this is brutality at its worst. And this was all going on while TransCanada supervisors were actively watching what happened. After the protesters finally gave up and released themselves, TransCanada supervisors congratulated the police on, I quote, a job well done, and encouraged that these tactics be used again in the future.
Is there a video of this?
No, before it could happen, police ran off all spectators with cameras, evacuated everyone else from the scene so no one could watch what was going on. That's not the first instance that police have taken cameras from spectators standing on private property, just watching blockades take place, watching people stop construction. These just innocent bystanders have had their cameras and their equipment taken, and none of the stuff is yet to be returned. It is unbelievable. And what makes matters worse is a lot of these police officers are working on TransCanada's dime. TransCanada's hired, their hired security are the sheriff's departments in these rural East Texas counties. So they've mandated the police officers to arrest anyone that sets foot on their property, even though that's not what an easement contract allows them to do. So you have police officers wearing state-issued uniforms, state-issued weapons, state-issued utility belts, but are working private security for TransCanada.
Unbelievable. Well, Ron, where can people support these actions? Where can they get more information?
Well, our website is tarsandsblockade.org. And there is an open call there for anyone and everyone that wants to participate in this campaign to stop the pipeline. There's a sign-up sheet. There's all different levels of participation. And, in fact, this coming weekend, although it's short notice at this point, there is a training camp, an action camp for folks that are interested in coming to Texas to be on the ground to participate more directly with the campaign. But the scope of what we're doing is becoming national. There's litigation moving forward against TransCanada. We're trying to organize landowners in a class against this eminent domain abuse. And we've got a lot of national support from national allies. So the campaign is growing, and there's room and plans for everyone to get on board. So now's the time. We still have time to stop the pipeline if we all get together and row in the same direction.
Well, Ron, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thanks so much, Sam. I appreciate you having me.
All right, folks. Well, we gave you a little bonus time. Tomorrow on the program, we will have a members-only show. I think we're going to run now I'm debating whether or not we should have an archive show from the Majority Report where Stephen Colbert filled in for me back in 2004, before he was even Stephen Colbert, where he was still Stephen Colbert. I'm joking. I mean, he was Stephon Colbert at that time, and then he didn't become Stephen Colbert. Or maybe we'll run the debate that I did the other night with that dude drinking with Bob. We'll probably run the drinking with Bob and save the Colbert one for a while. I don't know, because that way it'll be more timely. But folks, either way, you know how at the beginning of the show we say this is the award-winning Majority Report. Well, the reason why it's an award-winning Majority Report is because we won an award, the Podcast Award at podcastawards.com. We need you to go and nominate us, right, for Politics News and People's Choice.
Yes, those are the two.
Those are the two. So please do that now, folks. This is important. I don't want to have to, like, well, I suppose I could still say award-winning. I just wouldn't have to say what year it was. But nevertheless, it would be nice to win it 2 years in a row, because then it would be two years in a row.
And you know what? I would argue that we're even more deserving this year.
Yeah. Because
we've only improved.
Yeah, without a doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. And folks, you can also help. I don't know what has happened the past week, but we've had, I'd say over the past 4 days, more cancellations than we've had members. And a big part of that is just people have financial hardship. I understand. I don't, it's, but if you don't and you enjoy this program and you want it to continue, you don't want me out there. I don't know. I don't know what else I got to do. I don't know. Find another job. I don't know how many more jobs I can find at any given point. Stitch this thing together. In the coming days and weeks, I will explain to you why Nikki will be working a little less, and or might be. You know, it's always who knows. And so the burden's going to be more on me to drive, to bring home the bacon, as it were. So please, if you can afford to become a member of the show, you like what you hear, you don't want the corporate media to be the only media out there, you want to hear interviews with guys like Jeff Cotton and Tar Sands Blockade, you got to support the program. You can do so by becoming a member at majority.fm. There are other ways if you can't afford to, if you are fundamentally against paying for high-quality programming. You can then, if you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link, majority.fm, support the show. Click on the link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon junk through there. We get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate. You can buy some merch. You can give us a review on iTunes. Many different ways of supporting this program. We will see you in the better half. We'll be back live on Thursday from Las Vegas. Cliff Schechter will be joining me. I don't know who else will be at that tort conference. And then Thursday night, Cliff and I may try and do a live coverage of the VP debate. I don't know. The amount of programming that's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 days is just out of control. Just out of control.
Just the next 3 or 4 days. What are you talking about? We've had a crazy amount of programming for months now.
Years.
Years.
Literally years. Coming up on our 2-year anniversary, right? In
That's true. Wow.
In a month. Wow. All right, folks. See you on the better half.
Sitting at the pen.